So, Psalm 67. Well, my introductory comment, which may or may not be adequate, you just, when you're looking at the text yourself, you can check this. The psalmist wants the whole world to experience God's gracious providence and to respond in praise. This is quite a rare psalm in its universal view, Catholic in the best sense of that word, universally embracing. A lot of the psalms are very Jewish, as you'd expect them to be, but this one is about wanting the whole world to be caught up in praise of God. So we'll begin with verse 1. O God, be gracious to us and bless us. Show us the radiance of your face, that your way may be known upon earth, your saving power among the nations. So he wants the whole earth, the nations, to see God's saving power by God's graciousness to Israel. And once again, God be gracious to us. You'll find other translations will put, and it's fine, they'll say have mercy on us. I think be gracious is better, because the Hebrew is Hanan, so it means show us in many little ways. That's what that all gracious always means. That, as I'm translating it here, show us today and tomorrow and tonight and this morning and this afternoon. Keep little things happening in our lives that show us that you're with us and love us and care for us, blessing us. Show us the radiance of your face. I'll spend a bit of time on that, though we often find that in the Psalms. Is a lovely metaphor for, well, obviously if someone's face is radiant, they're smiling, aren't they? They're happy, they're not angry. The opposite of that is God's anger, which is looking quite different. So they want God to be, they want to see the radiance of God's face. In other words, they want to see God's beautiful love and care and providence for them. I'll just play with some of those images for a little while through the Old Testament and the New Testament, and you'll be familiar enough with these texts. There's one, the famous prayer, the priestly prayer, may Yahweh bless you and keep you. May Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So that prayer would have been always heard, as we hear it still in our liturgy, and no doubt it's the psalmist is just picking that up and going with it. Psalm 31, which we did last year, if you're with me, let your face shine upon your servant, meaning save me in your steadfast love. That's what it means to have God's face shining upon us. Psalm 80 we'll do later. Restore us, O God, let your face shine, that we may be saved. I guess the image is the sun, do you think? That seems to me the most likely metaphor, the sun shining, warming, nourishing, enlightening. So, and the smile of a person who loves you too. Psalm 89, happy are the people who walk, O Lord, in the light of your countenance. Teresa of Avila has a really lovely little phrase that you'll often use for your consolation, and we all need consoling. Look at him, she says, he never takes his eyes off you. That's the idea there. The light of God's countenance, God gazing with love upon us. And in Jesus' understanding, on simply everybody in the world, God never stops gazing with love upon every single human being. Sin does not stop God gazing with love. That's what we've got to get into our heads and teach our children and really know, that we don't change God. God is always graciously shining upon us. The problem is, if we pull the blinds, we can't see it, and we're in the dark. Do you get it? But we're in the... So sin matters. We don't want to say it doesn't matter what you do, God will love you. That's actually true. Except it doesn't is wrong. It matters what you do. God will continue to love you, but you won't receive the love if you reject it. It's the rejection of love that we do that locks us into the dark. And God will, for all eternity, love everybody because God is love. I'm sure you know that. But I think we have to keep hearing it because it's often presented differently, isn't it? And that's dreadful to present it differently. It's actually a heresy, but it's so common. It's amazingly common. Because we've got this funny idea that God will punish us or God will get back at us or God will finally win. When the chips are down, he'll have the last say. Well, if God had the last say, we'd all be in heaven, for heaven's sake. God has given us the last say. So if we reject love eternally, we reject love eternally. And that's what Jesus warned us about. That's hell. So it matters what we do because it matters that we welcome the beautiful face of God that is shining on us and don't turn our back on it. Is that okay? Psalm 89, I think I did that. Happy the people who walk in the light of your countenance. That's the point. Happy implies something to do with us, behavior, when you see the word happy. Blessed means God is blessing you. Fine. Happy is the word used like in the Beatitudes. Happy is what we experience when we respond. That's a different point. Then they're different angles on the same reality. So your happiness depends on your responding and my responding and walking in the light of the countenance. You can have the countenance and not walk in the light of it. So this is a Psalm 119, make your face shine on your servant, teach me your statutes. And finally I could give you millions of texts, not millions but a lot. Daniel chapter 9, now therefore, O our God, listen to the prayer of your servant and to his supplication. And for your own sake, Lord, let your face shine upon your desolated sanctuary. That's written at the time of the Syrian invasion under Antiochus Epiphanes IV in 168 BC when the temple was destroyed, it was profaned. And they put a statue of Zeus under one of the eastern names, Baal Sham, god of the heavens. They put a statue of Zeus in the very holy place, desecrated it. So this is a prayer that God will. Look at the New Testament just for a moment. Philip, at the Last Supper, asked to see God. This is the beautiful thing that's unique to Christianity. And Jesus said, well, if you see me, you see the Father. That's the essence of our Christian faith, that actually we can't make an icon of God, but God made an icon of God. God in Jesus revealed beautifully, perfectly, who God is. That's our faith. That's at the center of the Trinity, that Jesus is actually the one, the lover, who shows us that God is love. And so if I've got any ideas of God from the Old Testament or anywhere else that don't fit with Jesus, we can comfortably rub them out. They're actually wrong. That's our insight. So we keep looking at Jesus to see what God looks like, sounds like, responds. So that's what he's saying to Philip. If you see me, you see the Father. It was Jesus who made known upon earth God's gracious ways and saving power, and so revealed the radiance of God's face. And we contemplate Jesus, the radiance of God's glory. And here's the beautiful letter of Paul to the Ephesians, the opening verses, chapter 1, verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us in Christ with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. So if any of you suffer from scruples, and we do, some do, it's a psychological thing that some people have to suffer with, too concerned about our own behaviour and worried that God mightn't love, a lot of that comes from that teaching. God mightn't love me if I keep doing this thing that I've got a habit of doing, you know. People think that. Well, it's absolutely wrong, and we've got to say to people, no, 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 God never stops loving you. That isn't the thing. So let's try and deal with this situation as best we can. But knowing as a background to our effort, that one thing we're sure of is that God will never stop loving me. That's important, isn't it?
Yes.
I often used to think of imagine the prodigal son when he's in the pig yard and someone walking up to him and leaning over the fence and saying to the prodigal son, your father doesn't love you anymore. Imagine what that would do. Where does he go now? Except deeper into the despair. But no one said it to him, thank God. And had they done it, he probably wouldn't have believed it. So we must know that God never stops loving me. And Jesus showed that. So back to our psalm. Verse 3 is a refrain that we'll see repeated, in fact, in verse 5 straight away. But here's the point of the psalm. Let the peoples, and that always means not Jews, you know, not us, but the peoples, the other nations, let the Gentiles, let the peoples praise you, O God, let all the peoples praise you. That's our cry in this beautiful psalm. And then he says, let the nations be glad and sing for joy, for you judge the nation, the peoples with equity, and you govern the nations on earth. And then again comes the cry, let the peoples praise you, O God, let all the peoples praise you. So that those two refrains kind of hold the center. So that's going to be central to our psalm. Let the nations be glad and sing. Why? Because you judge the earth with equity and you govern the nations of the earth. So let's look a little bit, I mean, you could spend a month on this too, on God judging the world with equity. The justice of God. God always being God and never acting because of what we do, but acting because God is God, and therefore acting according to God's nature. Now, they didn't realize, as we do, that God is love, full stop. They had a whole lot of complex images of God, which we've inherited if we take the Bible flat and think it's all true equally, without looking for perspective in it, and without looking at the Old Testament. I remember when I first started to teach in the seminary, and I think this was a very good idea. They used to, in first year they taught reasonably, Introduction to the Old Testament was in the seminary in year one, Introduction to the New Testament was in year two in the seminary. And I came in and I thought, Introduction to the New Testament has to come first. You can only look at the Old Testament safely through the eyes of Jesus. Otherwise, what you do is, you look at the Old Testament and get those images of God and then you fit Jesus into them. Whereas we've got to look at Jesus and then be able to go back and critique and see the fulfillment in Jesus of the half-truths of the earlier texts. You know, I think that was, that's what I did, and I reckon it was very important to do that. So let's look at God's justice by reading one text only, Amos chapter 5, verse 14 to 24. So it's a two-page and fairly long text. Take the reference if you like it. And I'll just read it for you. Amos is the earliest of the writing prophets. Northern kingdom, just before the collapse, so 730, something like that, BC. 8th century prophet. And he writes, seek good and not evil, that you may live. And so Yahweh, the God of hosts, will be with you. Just as you have said. So they're all saying God will be with us, and he's saying, as does Jeremiah, in fact all the prophets, that's all very well to say God is with you, but are you with God? So seek good and not evil, so that it will be true and you'll really experience the joy of it all. Don't just take it for granted and live as though it's just something in place that you have nothing to do with. Hate evil and love good. establish, here it is, justice in the gate. And why in the gate? Because that's where they used to have their court. There's only space in the town, the walls of the town, and where the gate was, there was a piazza, or whatever you want to call it, and there was space, and they used to gather there and have their courts in the morning. So that's why it says in the gate. It may be that Yahweh, the God of hosts, will be gracious to the remnant of Joseph. There, Joseph is the northern kingdom. Joseph is Ephraim and Manasseh. They're the two sons in the story. We're not talking biology here or birth certificates. We're talking dramatic imagery of connections between people. So in that, is it mythology almost? Legendary stuff might be better. The two big tribes of Samaria, Manasseh and Ephraim, that's Joseph. So Joseph is really the whole of Samaria, the whole of the hill country, lower than Galilee and all the rest of it. So, obviously, this is where the danger is. This is where the Assyrians are coming in. This is where the war is going on. Joseph is being destroyed by the armies, and Amos is there, current writing. Well, it may be that God of hosts will be gracious to the remnant of Joseph. He might save us from the Assyrians. Therefore, thus says Yahweh, the God of hosts, Yahweh, in all the squares there shall be wailing, in all the streets they shall say, alas, alas. They shall call the farmers to mourning, and those skilled in lamentation to wailing. In all the vineyards there will be wailing, for I will pass through the midst of you, says Yahweh. Their image of God as the God who is justice, who is going to not let them get away with their... I hope you know Amos, I'm trying to tell you too much and too little. Amos is very much against wealth being abused and the reduction of the people to poverty and people buying up more and more land and the poor being just marginalised. It's very relevant stuff. Well, it does a bit, yeah. So he goes on, alas for you who desire the day of Yahweh. You want God to come. You better be careful, because when God comes, Amos is saying, God will judge you for what you're doing. Why do you want the day of Yahweh? It's darkness, not light. As if someone fled from a lion and was met by a bear. Or went into the house and rested a hand against the wall and was bitten by a snake. You're trying to escape the Assyrians, you want to go to God, but look, you people, it's his way of fire and brimstone. Don't take it as the last word on God, please. It's his image of God. Thanks to Jesus, we can clarify a lot of this, but let's stay with Amos. It's a day of darkness. Is not the day of Yahweh darkness, not light and gloom with no brightness in it? I hate, he's speaking on behalf of God, I despise your festivals, I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. So they're all trying to bargain with God, and instead of living a just life, they go to church and they do all the right things, they put money on the plate and they send their kids to school and they, you know what I mean, they do all this, but they're living a life of incredible injustice. So it's no substitute, he's saying. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. The offerings of well-being of your fatted animals, I won't look on them. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I won't listen to the melody of your harps. I'm not interested in cult if it's an attempt to win me over while you live an unjust life. You get the message? This is it. Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. So Amos is right at the heart of the Old Testament awareness of God as the God of the poor and the lonely and the broken and the orphans and the widows, and God will not tolerate injustice. So back to our psalm. Psalm 67, verse 6. The earth has yielded its harvest. Well, that's thanks be to God. See, that's the graciousness of God as they see it. The rain has come at the right time, and it's a wonderful season. So they're delighting in it. Here You don't need this, but I'll just show you three texts that say much the same. Leviticus chapter 26, I will give you rains in their season. The land shall yield its produce. The trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Ezekiel, the trees of the field shall yield their fruit, and the earth shall yield its increase. They shall be secure on their soil, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. A metaphor, I suppose, an indication of God's love for them. And Zechariah 8, there shall be a sowing of peace. The vine shall yield its fruit. The ground shall give its produce. The skies shall give their dew. And I will cause the remnant of his people to possess all these things. You can forgive some of the fundamentalist texts, sects, who, well, anyhow, you can forgive them for thinking that if you're a good person, you will be successful. They're very full of that. I mean, that's one of the things that they're kind of pushing. So if you're a multimillionaire, well, God obviously is blessing you like wonder. Because the Old Testament is a lot like that, isn't it? The whole of the book of Deuteronomy says if you live a good life, you'll live a long life, you'll be healthy, your kids will be successful, they'll all be married well, and they'll never divorce, and you know everything will go really swimmingly for you. So that's a good reason for being a good person. It doesn't work. I mean, I don't have to tell you that. It doesn't work like that. How do we know it doesn't work like that? Look at Jesus on the cross. 33, crucified. The most beautiful person one can imagine, but quite unsuccessful in the terms of, you know, what we're talking about. But he wasn't unsuccessful as loving. In fact, his love is enough to save the world if we want it. So by the real profound standards that we're looking at, it's a beautiful what Jesus did. But you could hardly call it a success in the human terms of, am I making sense? Yeah. Of physical, material wealth. You might be the most beautiful parent in the world and your kids may end up choosing to destroy themselves. Yeah. Don't go back and think you haven't been a good parent. Oh, thank you, Barbara. But if you read the Old Testament, especially the Deuteronomy book, and most of the history, the Deuteronomic school also wrote Joshua, Judges, Samuel and Kings. So you're dealing with the book of Deuteronomy and all those history, they're not history, those early prophetic books were written by that one school prior to the death of the great King Josiah. And the great King Josiah, the second David, who was restoring, or actually probably for the first time managing to get the whole of Palestine becoming, you know, Israel, and all the promises they were hoping for were being achieved by this young, wonderful king who reformed the country, who got rid of the foreign gods, who was an absolute saint, and he was killed at the Battle of Megiddo. Now, what did that do to the theology? Theology has to keep growing. The theology of the book of Deuteronomy suddenly came under an enormous question. How could this be? How could success be the result of this? So they had to go deeper. And they did. And then you get into the exile, and which is a lovely religious period. And then you get into the books of Job and Ecclesiastes, you know, which question this kind of... So we too have to keep questioning our theology in the light of the discoveries of science and archaeology, don't we? We do have to. We have to look for the truth, only the truth. And our understandings of God are so imperfect, we're on a journey of constant discovery. So we need to read the Old Testament carefully. Verse 6 continues in our little psalm, God, our God, blesses us. God blesses us. Let the ends of the earth revere him. And that's the end of our psalm. Simple psalm. I think quite a beautiful one. And I'll conclude with a statement from Ezekiel chapter 34, a kind of promise, hope that the prophet expresses in God's name and from his prayer. I will make them and the region around my hill a blessing. I will send down the showers in their season. They shall be showers of blessing. The trees of the field shall yield their fruit, and the earth shall yield its increase. They shall be secure on their soil, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. When I break the bars of their yoke and save them from the hands of those who enslaved them. Brackets. This is written in exile. They shall no more be plunder for the nations, nor shall the animals of the land devour them. They shall live in safety, and no one shall make them afraid. I will provide for them a splendid vegetation, so that they shall no more be consumed with hunger in the land, and no longer suffer the insults of the nations. They shall know that I, Yahweh their God, am with them, and that they, the house of Israel, are my people, says the Lord Yahweh.